Welcome to the Ask Sensei Tony podcast, where Sensei will address your questions about life from a cosmic perspective. Please subscribe and ask a question at AskSenseiTony.com to find out more about studying with Sensei privately, becoming a part of our spiritual community, and training to become a mindful minister of oneness in our seminary. We hope you enjoy this episode and find it helpful.
Hi, everybody. This is Sensei Tony. And before I deliver the first talk today, I want you to all say hi to Sir Basil. He always comes up and sits with me while we are recording. And he's a very loving and peaceful presence. So I wanted to say, everybody say hi, Basil. I thought it was especially appropriate today because our question comes from Patrick. And Patrick asks, "Dear Sensei Tony, what can we learn from our animal companions?"
First of all, thank you, Patrick. It's a good question. Recently, I was meeting with a friend of mine who also is a student, studies with me. And he was sharing about how their family had just lost a beloved pet. And, you know, sometimes when we go through that kind of experience, we might hesitate to share that information with someone who we think would maybe judge us as being a little too soft. It's just a pet, just an animal. And I think that there's a lot of there's usually some kind of reaction. Like if you're a pet lover and you've had a lot of pets and they're very close to you and they're part of your life and your animal companionship, then of course right away you're gonna relate to what that person's saying. On the other hand, if you're not that way, you may have a difficult time making that connection. Now, I think this is a very important subject and one that I am happy to address. So the short answer is yes, we can learn a lot from our animal companions. I've had dogs and cats. When I was a boy, we had a black Labrador whose name was Trevor. My wife and I first got married. We took care of her parents' dog, Jackie, beautiful Siberian Husky. And then pretty much from then on, we have had cats. Now, when I was a boy, I had there were two cats that I had when I was very little, Susie and Goldie, and I always loved cats. And then I had another cat when I was in my late teens, very early 20s, named TJ. And then, so when my wife and I first got married, it was after, it was actually during the time we had Jackie. We got ourselves a little kitten, and his name was Dow. And after that, he was with us for 13 years, and then we had, it was about 14 years actually, and then we had Keto, who had been a stray that we found along with her mother and her siblings at a building. They were outside a building where I used to do retreats in Harrisburg called Fort Hunter. Really cool place. And so everybody there was there for the retreat. Everybody took one home. So it was a beautiful experience. And we had Keto for 13 years. Both of them died of cancer. And then about a year ago, we found Sir Basil of Catbone, whom we love dearly. I also have to say that when I was a kid, I had a lot of other pets or a lot of other creatures that I kept periodically, and that included a lot of salamanders. We lived in New York. We lived near Woodstock, and we lived on a dead-end street, and so we had a forest behind us, and we had all these creatures. And so I used to collect salamanders and also snakes. Much to my mother's chagrin. I have to tell you a quick story. So I loved living in the woods. And I loved, you know, being outdoors all the time. And it was a cool period in the late 60s where, you know, you really could. You could do that. It was pretty safe. Pretty safe, I should say. but a lot of stories from there. But one time, so I used to collect snakes. And they were, you know, garter snakes. So they're not poisonous. But they do bite. And so one of the things that I would do is I would catch them. And you learn how to catch them by sort of like, you know, you grabbing them right behind the jaws. So you grab them right behind the jawline, right behind their head. And then they just curl up around you and they can't bite you. But I put them in a big mayonnaise jar. I mean, a big mayonnaise jar, really big. And I didn't want my mom to know that I had them. So I thought, well, I'll hide them in the laundry room. And I put them up on a shelf. And the next day I came down and went in the laundry room, and fortunately my mom had not been in there yet. And the jar was in shards of glass everywhere, the glass was there. So I guess the movement of all these, because it was pretty full of snakes, it had sort of fallen off, and the snakes were gone. So I don't know where they went. I'm assuming they found their way out through the drains and stuff like that. Nonetheless, I did... I don't know if I got in trouble for that or not, if I was able to cover up my crime before that. But anyhow, you know, so let's get back to the question that Patrick had. So it's obvious that animals can be companions, and it doesn't matter what kind of animal. You know, sometimes I've known people that have lizards they feel very close to, fish, various mammals, from dogs and cats to rabbits and horses, etc. What can we learn from them? Well, I think there's a couple important things we can learn. At least I'm going to share you my opinion of what I've learned from them. And I'll probably talk about specifically my personal relationship with pets. First thing I want to say is that we have a great tendency as humans to project our humanness onto other things, and that's called anthropomorphism. And it's something we do, and it's like I've said in many other talks that projection is not something we can stop doing. It's something we can wake up to the fact we're doing. And I think one of the biggest things we do wrong to an animal is not understanding that first and foremost that they are not human. So no matter how much we may project human qualities onto them, they're not human. And for me, this comes from a deep place of respect for their being as an animal. And so whether wild or domesticated, I think that we should start with the understanding that this is not a human but an animal. And so we can't project either negative or positive qualities onto animals. I think that's really important. I remember one time we visited, a group of our clergy visited some Orthodox monks at New Skete in Cambridge, New York. And I was really fascinated by their monastic community and what they were doing. And so we became friendly there, and really great, great bunch of people. And they raised dogs, and some of you may be familiar. They were pretty famous a while back where they had raised dogs that German shepherds, and that was part of their income that they provided for themselves. And I remember one of the brothers saying that, and these guys love these dogs, and it's just incredible to see the way they interact with them, and they raise them from puppies, you know. And he just said that they start out from that point, even though for them in some ways, dogs in their language would be expression of God, that they still have to start by respecting them as animals and not expecting them to have the same sort of way of being as humans. And that always stood out for me, and I think you got to respect that. And it's very interesting because when an animal does something, there's a certain innocence that we attribute to it. So if my cat, Basil seems to be a bit of a, I call him the bodhisattva cat because he doesn't seem to kill things. He'll capture them, but he doesn't kill them. So when we were in Florida, he actually put it in his mouth a small lizard, a gecko, but he didn't eat it, and he just played with it very gently for a while, to the point where after about an hour and a half, I felt bad for the gecko, so I put the gecko out outside the fence. And the other time, just the other day, I was outside writing, and he captured this bird in his paws, and it was struggling, and he was watching it, and then he just kind of opened his hands and watched it fly away. So he's a sport hunter. He doesn't seem to kill unless he needs to eat, I guess, which is pretty cool. So that's a lesson, which I'll come back to. Now, Keto, she was different, and that's one of the things I found about animals. They all have their unique personalities and ways of being, and I always called her my mighty huntress because she killed lots of things. She would kill rabbits and birds and pretty much anything that got in her path. And she was, like I say, she was feral, she was wild. And we found her at the Fort Hunter retreat place that I did retreats at. And she was not someone that you could, carry around and hold. She would let me hold her, and she would lay with me. But she really wasn't that keen on doing that with anyone else. And she was friendly, but she also could be very fierce. And so she was a hunter, and we have a statue of Kanzeon, which is the archetype Buddha Bodhisattva of compassion, and she would put the animal there like an offering to us, either saying, here's my contribution, or I'm worried that you're not enough good enough hunter, so I want to make sure you can get enough to eat. I loved her dearly, but they're not human, and so I don't think we should ascribe to them human qualities. And in some ways, you might say it's a bit of a blessing for them that they don't really hold on to things the way we do because they don't have the same type of brain. So when there's trouble for them, they they basically will react to that trouble. But once the trouble's gone, they kind of go back to their normal set rate. And as I've said in other talks, I think that, it's very clear from a number of animal behaviorists, one of my favorites being Cesar Millan, that just like children, young children, animals are kind of satellites of their owner's psyches. So if the human's messed up, it tends to have a reverberation effect on the the animal who's present. And do animals grieve and that sort of thing? That's a very good question. I think all animals that have developed what I would say a mammalian part of the brain, mammals have a mammalian brain like we do, rather. And because of this, they love to hug, they love to be hugged, they love to be held tight, they love to be kind of, groomed and petted, and that closeness, physical closeness, and the smell, and of course the association with that, they become very attached to their owners, and the owners obviously to them. And so, if you took that person away for any considerable period of time, I think that there would definitely be a reaction from that place. But I don't think it would last very long. I think that it would probably last as long as there was no other presence to replace that in their life. And, you know, do animals give unconditional love? Well, it depends on how you define that. I mean, if you stop feeding them, I don't know. So I think there's part of it is that you're feeding them. So, you know, they'll hang around longer. I'm just kind of kidding. But, you know, I don't really like the word unconditional love because it seems to put before us the idea of some kind of perfect love that, and I just don't think that's realistic. And I don't think we need it. I think we can have really beautiful relationships and we can have really wonderful connections without having them to be perfect or unconditional, whatever that means. I think we can kind of open ourselves up a little bit to an unconditional regard for ourselves and others. And just like in our four-direction system of mindfulness, we talk about that in the true self-esteem model, where we learn to estimate ourselves or value ourselves as a belief of our inherent worth that can't be added or subtracted from by the world of doing and having. But that being said, like I said, I've said before, I'm not a big fan of the word unconditioned. Not in the conditioned realm. So, and I should say, as I'm thinking, saying that, I was just thinking that, you know, the true self metaphor or Buddha nature is a way of pointing at something unconditioned or nirvana. But again, it's a symbol. It's not the thing itself, even if it in some way participates in it, unlike a sign or a simile. So, what can we learn? Well, so I say, the foundation, I think, is first by respecting, a deep sense of respect for their animal nature and what they are, and not project onto them anything initially, but just let them be what they are. And secondly, when we're projecting anthropomorphic qualities onto them, to wake up to know that we're doing that, so that there's a balance between what they are and what we need. And it's tough, you know, I've experienced it myself, and I've seen it in lots of other folks that, like, for example, when an animal is, you know, starting to deteriorate through illness or age, there's a tendency to try to hang on to that animal as long as you can. And I'm not judging that, I understand it. But I do think that that's part of it. You know, we're kind of not so much concerned for the well-being of that creature as much as we are for the attachment we have for that creature. So that's a con for us to wrestle with. I can tell you that with both Dao and Keto, where they had to be put to sleep because of their suffering, while I felt it was the right thing to do not to prolong that, and it was obvious that they were in great pain, it didn't make it any easier. And it's a difficult thing to do. But I do believe it was the right thing at that time. So anyhow, that's one way in which that dynamic, or that it can be a duality, but I think it can also be a healthy dynamic if we understand that basis. What do they teach us? So animals don't talk back. They might meow or bark or some other noise. But they're a great way to get stuff out of our heads and talk about things. And I talk to Basil all the time. And the nice thing is they don't talk back. They just kind of listen. And it really helps. It really helps. And I don't think you can underestimate that. So they're very much a presence, just as Basil is, you know, here. It's very peaceful. And there's something about caring for a pet that I think is important, because it gets you out of your own, you know, sort of more egocentric orientation, to where you're kind of, you know, you're thinking about somebody else, taking care of somebody else. I think it's a great way to learn how to take care of a child. And I think once you've had a child, as I have, then one of the things you notice is that you have a tendency to take those same qualities that you had when you were a parent to a small child, and you kind of do those with a dog and or a cat, and you kind of see people do that all the time. And I really understand that. I get it. So, you know, so I think we can learn from them is that another thing we can learn from them is that they well, I would say this, I don't know if, you know, maybe this is true for all animals, but I would say especially for, I'm going to talk about cats because that's what I'm more inclined towards, but they really teach you how to be present. I mean, I think the thing that, you know, just a simple example, when I was finishing my last book, The Three Principles of Oneness, How to Embody the Cosmic Perspective and Liberate Your Life, when I was working on the final edits of that with my publisher, Basil, he would often, like, at a certain point during the day, he'd kind of hop up my lap, and it was kind of like him saying, hey, Dad, you know, it's time to stop, take a break. And so I would, and it was really great to have him kind of helping me be mindful to step back from what I was doing and live in the present, live in the now. And that's so true. I think animals do that and live that way much the way young kids do. And it's such a brilliant way for us to kind of remember that part of our, at least my understanding, part of our true self is that natural child within us that is playful and joyful. And I think that that's a very healthy thing to express. So they teach us so many things, and I'm going to summarize that, you know, summarize it one more time. But one thing that people ask me is, like, when a pet dies, you know, we actually at our temples or centers, we have one time during the year we will have the blessing of the beasts, which is usually in the spring or summer, and that's where people can bring their animals to the temple, and we will do a blessing of them, recognizing that they too are Buddha nature. And when someone has a beloved pet die, we will perform a memorial or funeral for that animal and honor that relationship, that deep relationship. And I think that's really important. So the question inevitably comes up, what happens? Will I ever see my pet again? And I remember one time doing a memorial for a man who was in his 70s, and his dog had died. And, you know, he was kind of embarrassed to even ask me the question, but he said, do you think that I'll ever see this dog again? And it was so sweet. And I told him, well, I can offer you my opinion. And that I have my deep abiding faith is in oneness and in the oneness of all life. And I don't think that anything can separate us from that oneness, not even death. So I think that who we are as human beings is not just something that exists solitary or away from everything else or some kind of independent existence, but I believe that everything is interdependent. So I am deeply shaped by my relationships, and who I am is a large part of that is shaped by my relationships. So yeah, I don't think we're ever separated from, in oneness we are never really truly separate. So for me, I said, yeah, I think someday you'll play once again among the fields of the true country. So that's it. So I think the important thing here, you know, kind of review, and I hope I get them all in there, is first of all, they recognize that they're animals, not humans. And so, well, you know, you might say we're animals too, but they're different from us, and we need to respect them as that and not project onto them our feelings, our concerns, our human traits, because it's just not fair to them and not true. And secondly, they are incredible companions in that their presence is very much one of helping us to stay in the now. And they make they're great listeners and companions, and that we can always learn from them about more about our own Buddha nature. Because if everything has Buddha nature, and particularly these animals have Buddha nature, then certainly we can learn more about our own from them. So I hope that was very useful to you, and talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Ask Sensei Tony. Please visit our website at AskSenseiTony.com, check out Sensei's books and videos, and become a part of the Dragonfly spiritual lifestyle.